The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs, and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable tales of terror. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show. Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast, bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Listener discretion is advised. Greetings, listeners, and welcome back to Horror Hill. I'm your host, Eric Peabody. And tonight's episode includes two stories, both featuring lone protagonists in bizarre situations. First up is The Night Siren by Craig Groshek. Our protagonist, Dennis, awakes one night to the sound of an odd siren. He lives on a quiet suburban street, and this is a bit of an oddity. The weirdness deepens when he sees the ambulance, which is unlike any emergency vehicle he's seen before. But that's just the beginning of Dennis's troubles, as the crew of this ambulance does not seem to have his best interests at heart. To close, we'll be reading The Box by Layla Aaron. Martin Greaves is a man with a very lonely, very tedious task ahead of him. He is to go through the long-abandoned 16-floor Cortland Municipal Archive and catalog the various documents and detritus prior to the building's demolition. Martin enjoys his work, but runs into a bit of a snag when he finds a corridor that isn't on the building schematics. This leads Martin deeper into the heart of the building, where he encounters a strange box with undeniable links to his own life. One last note, listeners. Spring has begun here in good old Western New York, and my sinuses have been blessed with the resulting pollen and debris. Today's readings are slightly more congested than usual, so I'll apologize in advance. I've at least edited out the sniffling and sneezing. Ah, the joys of nature. You're listening to the free edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, so what are you waiting for? Also, if you're watching on YouTube, do us a favor and drop a like and subscribe. Become part of our dark circle, listeners. And now, from author Craig Groshek, I give you The Night Siren. Part 1. It was the siren that woke him, though the sound at first didn't register as real. It wormed its way into his half-dreaming consciousness, a drawn-out wail that ebbed and surged, pitching awkwardly between mournful and mechanical. Dennis blinked against the dark, lifting his head from the pillow as the noise crescendoed. It didn't belong in his neighborhood, not at that hour. His hand found the phone on the nightstand and turned it over. The screen, dimmed by his Do Not Disturb settings, still showed the time clearly, 3:03 a.m. For a moment, he simply stared at it, trying to understand why that felt wrong, even though he couldn't have said what time he had expected. The sound, a Doppler rise, grew closer. It wasn't smooth, but erratic, as if the vehicle producing it were drifting through uneven terrain or phasing in and out of range. Dennis sat up, glancing at the far side of the bed, which remained empty. Daisy, his 12-pound terrier mix, was already off the floor and circling the room in anxious loops, claws ticking lightly on the hardwood. He stood and crossed the window, pulling back the curtain with slow fingers. The street outside was dark and familiar in the way that all sleeping neighborhoods become familiar, an expanse of dormant shapes, blackened windows, and washed-out street lamps. But the siren was real now, undeniably present, echoing down the road and drawing nearer by the second. Then he saw it. The ambulance appeared around the far bend of the subdivision, headlights low and sweeping, its red and white lights casting an irregular strobe across siding and mailboxes. Dennis narrowed his eyes. Something about the vehicle's dimensions was off. It looked taller than it should have been, and narrower at the base. The color was wrong, too. Not quite red and not quite white, but a sallow, jaundiced palette that made him think of old bones and nicotine stains. Even the decals, what little he could make out through the flashes, seemed misplaced, as if someone had tried to approximate what an ambulance should look like based on secondhand descriptions, and failed to get the shape or proportions just right. Its movement was oddly silent apart from the siren, which stuttered and pulsed with an unnatural rhythm. The engine made no sound that Dennis could hear. The vehicle glided instead of rolled, giving the impression that it was being pushed from behind or pulled along by invisible threads. The driver came into view only briefly as the vehicle passed beneath the glow of a lamppost. Dennis leaned closer to the glass, eyes straining. The figure behind the wheel was hunched low, the shoulders pulled up almost to the ears, as though its bones had collapsed. Its face, or rather the space where a face should have been, appeared incomplete and blurred, as if wrapped in static. The driver's edges fluttered like heat ripples rising off asphalt, a constant shimmer that denied clear definition. Dennis felt an immediate, involuntary chill settle across his back. For a moment, he convinced himself it was passing through. The siren had begun to taper, softening into the distance. But then, without any warning, without so much as a flicker of brake lights, the vehicle made a sharp turn and pulled directly into his driveway. The siren cut off instantly. Dennis didn't move. He remained at the window, motionless, watching the silent ambulance idle no more than 15 feet from his front door. There was no reason it should have stopped there. No one on his block was ill, and no emergency had been reported, as far as he knew. Nothing had happened to warrant such a vehicle, at that hour, parking itself outside his house. Down at his side, Daisy began to growl. He stepped back from the window slowly, eyes still fixed on the shape of the thing parked below. The rear door of the ambulance opened with a motion that looked both mechanical and utterly wrong. The form of the figure that stepped out was unlike anything Dennis had ever seen, and demonstrably inhuman. It moved like it had learned to walk from watching someone else do it once and poorly. The limbs were jointed where they shouldn't have been, the elbows reversed, the gait uneven. Its shoulders rolled too far forward, head angled downward, obscuring any remaining hope of a facial structure beneath the shuddering veil of its silhouette. The streetlight overhead failed to touch its surface, as though its body absorbed light entirely. Its arms hung too low, the tendril-like hands at the end of them curling inward like the twisted limbs of old, dried vines. And with each lurching step toward Dennis's house, it seemed to drag something unseen behind it, something that didn't belong to this world at all. Dennis remained at the bedroom window, frozen not by indecision, but by the deep-rooted sense that movement might betray him. Below, Daisy's growl escalated to a sharp, staccato burst of barking that grew more insistent with every second. She pressed her front paws against the windowpane by the stairs, her body taut with frantic energy. She was no longer barking to warn, Dennis realized, but to protect. The figure reached the front porch and extended one of its grotesque appendages toward the door. Dennis watched with rising horror as its hand met the surface, the fingers splaying out across the wood like some gnarled, grasping starfish. The nails, or what passed for them, scraped against the paint with a sound that carried up the stairwell. Then the hand withdrew, reconfigured itself into something vaguely resembling digits, and pressed the doorbell once, twice, three times in quick succession. The sound it produced was somehow wrong, even though it rang with the exact tone Dennis had heard 100 times before. Daisy exploded into an unrestrained frenzy. Her nails scraped against the tile near the front entry as she bounded back and forth, barking so forcefully that her whole body pitched forward with every breath. Dennis tore himself away from the window and moved to the stairs, trying to whisper her name, hushing her with gentle tones, even as the panic in his own voice betrayed him. "Daisy, no, quiet! Come here, girl, quiet!" She ignored him completely. He descended halfway and crouched beside the banister, trying to coax her back, but she wouldn't move. The thing outside seemed to respond to her outburst. The head, which had remained slumped and twitching, suddenly turned upward with the stiffness of a marionette on frayed strings. It peered through the frosted glass of the door. Then, slowly, it raised its face toward the second-story window where Dennis had stood just moments before. Its gaze found him immediately. Dennis recoiled instinctively, ducking behind the banister and pressing his back to the wall. The creature had seen him. Of that, there was no question. He backed up the stairs, forcing his legs to move despite the numbness blooming in his knees. From the corner of his vision, he saw the figure leave the porch. He didn't hear footsteps, only the sound of something dragging across the grass and gravel, moving laterally along the face of the house. Dennis retreated to the upstairs hallway, peeking from a crouch at the side window above the garage. The figure was there, its silhouette just visible in the moonlight as it moved toward the side gate. A low, rattling clatter followed, as though it had tested the latch without success. Then it proceeded onward, around the back. He rushed to the rear bedroom and carefully peeled back the curtain. The creature came into view again, now pacing slowly past the sliding glass door, its form indistinct. It pressed a hand briefly to the glass, leaving behind a greasy smear that shimmered faintly before fading. It moved like it knew the layout of the house already. Then, it vanished from view. Dennis's breath hitched as he stepped away from the window. He turned back toward the hallway, only to freeze as a soft tap came from just outside the window he had been watching from moments earlier. A rhythmic, unnatural scuffling. Something was climbing. He fell to his knees beside the dresser and crept toward the window again. He peered over the sill and saw it. The figure had scaled the outer wall, its malformed limbs twisting like broken scaffolding, bent at angles that defied both physics and biology. Its head was now level with the window, and it was watching him. Not the room, him. Yellow eyes, with vertical slits blinking sideways, glowed from within a sea of shadow. Dennis fell backward and scrambled across the floor, nearly tripping over Daisy as she dashed into the room behind him. He seized her, wrapped his arms around her shaking frame, and crawled toward the closet, pulling the door closed behind them both. Inside the dark, he sat trembling, Daisy whining quietly against his chest. The creature was still out there, and now it knew where to look. Part 2. Dennis had no idea how long he stayed in the closet. Daisy shifted in his lap, ears perked, occasionally growling low in her throat. He didn't dare open the door until her tremors lessened, and even then, he only did so inch by inch. The hallway beyond remained dark and still. He rose slowly, every joint tight with tension, and edged back toward the bedroom window. The figure was gone. Dennis crept toward the glass and lifted the edge of the curtain. He expected to see an empty lawn or perhaps the ambulance still idling in the driveway. Instead, he caught sight of movement just as the figure slipped around the far corner of his house, vanishing from view. For a moment, he allowed himself the hope that whatever it was had given up, or at least was retreating. But then, the back doors of the ambulance opened, Dennis watched in breathless disbelief as something black oozed from within, spilling onto the pavement in viscous ropes. It gathered and rose, building height and form until four distinct shapes had assembled, each larger than the first. They did not move like the driver had. They did not stumble or stutter. They moved slowly and steadily, with purpose. Each of the new figures clutched something long and coarse in its grasp. Dennis squinted through the dimness, struggling to make out the details, until a gust of wind shifted the porch light just enough to illuminate them. Ropes. Coiled lengths of frayed rope, fashioned into crude nooses, hung from their hands, prepared for use. The four figures began to disperse, each one breaking away from the others with mechanical rhythm. One made its way around the left side of the house, another toward the rear. A third disappeared toward the right, while the last advanced toward the front door where the driver had first stood. Dennis moved to the other window and confirmed what he feared. They were encircling the house. Dennis reached for his phone. His fingers trembled against the touchscreen as he tapped in the unlock code and then navigated to the keypad and hit 911. He had no signal. Not poor signal or searching, not even a spinning wheel of anticipation. Just two plain, gray words in a corner of the screen. No service. Daisy began barking again downstairs. Dennis's attention snapped toward the stairwell. The dog had positioned herself at the rear door, her body tense, barking directly into the glass. Reacting instinctively, Dennis quickly descended the steps, taking two at a time despite the tightness in his calves, and turned into the kitchen. Daisy's body stiffened as he approached, her tail bristled to full alert. He reached for her, just as the door exploded with force from the outside, the entire pane shuddering in its frame. One of the creatures had slammed into it. Dennis stumbled backward, dragging Daisy with him by the collar. The figure on the other side of the door had spread its arms across the glass, pressing the tips of its fingers against the surface until they distorted and smeared. The shadows trailing from its hands didn't stay outside. Instead, oily tendrils of black smoke began to seep from the corners of the doorframe, curling like steam along the kitchen tile. The smoke moved with intelligence, snaking in loops and trails that avoided obstacles, navigating directly toward Dennis and the dog. He turned to the drawer near the sink where the knives were kept, yanked it open, and grabbed the handle of a large kitchen blade. The metal felt absurdly small and useless in his hand. Then his heel caught on the edge of a misplaced rug. His legs went out from under him in a violent lurch. His spine collided with the floor hard enough to send stars scattering across his vision. His head snapped back, colliding with the tile behind it. There was a sickening crack he couldn't immediately identify. Bone, floor, or both. The knife skittered across the tile and vanished under the table. Dennis tried to sit up, but the pain that radiated from his lower back brought a yell to his throat that never made it past his lips. He rolled to his side and fumbled for his phone, still clutched in his right hand. Blood smeared across the screen. He tapped 911 again, and this time it rang. A hiss of static filled the speaker. "Hello? Hello, this is 911. What's..." Dennis's voice cracked as he tried to speak. "There's someone here. Something... please..." The words on the other end broke into garbled shrieks and interference. He thought he could make out fragments of speech, perhaps a voice beneath the static, but they were fragmented, submerged beneath noise like a radio left to rot underwater. "I can't... please, they're trying to get in!" He tried again, but his own voice sounded alien to his ears. The line went dead. He stared at the screen, blinking away tears of pain and frustration. The phone displayed a "call failed" message. He was still cut off. And now, the shadows had made their way inside. Dennis remained on the floor, limbs twisted beneath him at unnatural angles, pain radiating from his spine. His head throbbed in rhythm with the high-pitched ringing in his ears. He blinked against the haze in his vision, struggling to keep his eyes open, his body refusing to cooperate. The fall had taken more out of him than he had realized. Daisy was still barking, but her voice had grown thin and distant, as though muffled by something unseen. He couldn't tell whether the change was in the room or within his own hearing, but the result was the same. Her frantic warnings felt as though they came from the end of a long hallway, one he could no longer reach. The wraiths continued to bleed through the edges of the house, moving with purpose. They came through vents, drifting like ash. They seeped beneath window frames, pooled beneath the floorboards, and rose in veins along the drywall. Dennis made a half-hearted attempt to move, forcing himself to one elbow, but seized as the pain in his lower back became unbearable. A wave of nausea rolled through him, and he lowered himself again with a groan. He had no choice but to lie there and watch. From his vantage point, he saw one of the creatures drift toward the living room window, the largest of them all. Its shadow pressed against the glass, and the surface bent inward, warping and flexing like elastic stretched too far. Its hand, or what served as one, dragged across the pane too fluidly, as though its bones had melted. It left behind no fingerprints, only a trail of condensation that refused to fade. The lights overhead began to flicker again. The ceiling fan sputtered and stopped. A distant hum, like the grinding of a far-off engine, grew steadily louder, and then, abruptly, cut off. Then came a sound so dreadful and out of place that it didn't register as real at first. Knocking. Human and measured. Not the insectile tapping that had preceded every unnatural presence thus far, but three solid raps against the front door. Dennis blinked hard, his mind working to catch up to the moment. Another knock followed, this time accompanied by a voice. "Sir? Emergency services! Are you all right in there?" He felt tears prick the corner of his eyes, not from emotion, but from the sudden release of tension that came with the sound of a real human voice. His jaw trembled. He tried to answer, to call out, but his voice came as little more than a strained rasp. Then the front door opened, hinges creaking wide as two uniformed paramedics stepped into the entryway, halting in place almost immediately. Dennis watched them from the kitchen floor, their faces twisted first into confusion, then concern. One of them coughed, waving a hand in front of his face as the faint haze of black smoke met his nose. "Jesus," the first muttered. "What the hell happened here?" They moved quickly after that. The second paramedic crossed the room and knelt beside Dennis, shining a small penlight into his eyes. Dennis tried to speak again, and when he finally managed to, the words came out clumsy and crowded.
"There was another ambulance before you," he managed. "Wrong callers, wrong everything. It came here first."
"Let's worry about that later," the paramedic said, cutting him off in a tone not unkind. "You've taken a serious fall. There's some bleeding at the back of your head. Do you know your name?" Dennis nodded.
"Dennis."
"Good. Can you feel your legs, Dennis?"
"Yes, they just hurt. Everything hurts."
"We're going to get you stabilized and out of here. Try not to move." Dennis caught a glimpse of Daisy barking in the background as the paramedics unrolled the gurney. She was still positioned near the back door, tail rigid, her body bristling with defiance as she growled at something Dennis could no longer see. The paramedics worked quickly but carefully, lifting him onto the stretcher with practiced hands, securing the straps across his chest and legs. His vision faded in and out as they wheeled him across the floor and into the night air. The moment the cool air touched his skin, he shivered. The scent of smoke and something older still clung to him, woven into the fabric of his shirt and hair. He turned his head slightly and caught sight of the real ambulance parked in his driveway, standard white and red, marked with clean lines and official logos. There were no shadows around it. It hummed with the quiet of a well-maintained engine, and nothing more. They loaded him inside. One paramedic climbed in after him, while the other circled around to the driver's seat. Daisy's barking continued behind him, sharp and high as a fire alarm. For a brief, impossible moment, Dennis wondered whether they would let her come. But then the doors closed, sealing him inside. And for the first time that night, he believed he might actually be safe. Part 3. The inside of the ambulance was bathed in sterile fluorescence. Below them, Dennis lay strapped to the gurney, every bump in the road radiating through his spine. Though the straps were snug and the stretcher bolted in place, he felt a growing instability under him. The attending paramedic, short-haired and middle-aged, with weary eyes that betrayed the long nights he'd been working, sat beside him and checked the IV line for the third time. His voice was calm but clipped, the practice tone of someone trying to manage panic.
"You've got a mild concussion. Your spine's not broken, but you've definitely done some damage. Probably hairline fractures in the lumbar. You'll be okay, but you're going to need scans."
Dennis tried to focus on his face, trying to keep his thoughts tethered to the inside of this vehicle, but his eyes kept drifting toward the rear windows. The world beyond them was dark and uneven, an indistinct wash of rural roads and scattered trees. Then he saw it. It was back. The other ambulance, the wrong one, followed them at a distance, its headlights off, just barely visible in the gloom of early morning. It moved with the eerie, stuttering glide of something not subject to the same physics as the rest of the world. It bore no sound, no rumble of tires or churn of engine. It simply closed the distance.
"It's behind us,"
Dennis croaked, the words catching on the ragged edge of his throat.
"The one from before. It's following us."
The paramedic turned and peered through the rear window, frowning.
"There's nothing there."
"There is,"
Dennis said, his voice rising.
"I saw it pull into my driveway. It sent them. Those things. I'm telling you, it's following us now."
The man's brow furrowed, and he leaned back to the console to radio something to the driver. But Dennis wasn't listening anymore. He had twisted as far as the restraints would allow and was staring into the dark. The other ambulance had drawn closer. Its shape was clearer now. The distorted height, the unnatural proportions, the off-color panels that looked more like slabs of discolored skin than paint. The driver was still visible, hunched over the wheel, flickering like a half-rendered memory, its face a grotesque, smeared imitation of a human visage. Then the vehicle accelerated, still completely silent, gaining on them in impossible increments. The distance closed in heartbeats. It was coming too fast. Dennis shouted,
"It's going to hit us!"
The driver's response was inaudible from the back, but Dennis saw the man's silhouette shift with alarm. The paramedic beside him turned toward the window again, saw nothing, and looked back with a confused expression that never had time to evolve into fear. The collision struck like a bomb. The ambulance lurched violently, tires screaming, the metal frame twisting with the sound of screeching metal. The road vanished as the vehicle veered off the shoulder and tumbled down an embankment, bouncing against rocks and scrub. Dennis felt the straps dig into his chest and thighs, his body weight shifting unnaturally with each roll. Everything became inverted, floor to ceiling, then back again. The fluorescent lights burst, showering the interior with sparks and shrapnel. Somewhere, glass shattered. Then, silence. He didn't know how long he was out. When his awareness returned, it did so in fragments. There was a high, whining tone in his ears, and his vision pulsed at the edges. The smell of burned wiring and blood filled his nostrils. The world was sideways.
He lay trapped, half-pinned beneath a crumpled cabinet, his legs twisted beneath the collapsed gurney frame. Across from him, the attending paramedic hung limp in his harness. A thick stream of blood trailed down the side of his neck. His eyes were open, but unseeing. The only other movement came from the driver's side. The second paramedic, alive, though barely, was crawling toward the back of the ambulance, dragging his body with one functioning arm. His face was torn, a long gash running across his forehead. He coughed, spat blood, and blinked through tears. Dennis tried to speak, but his lungs refused air. Then came the sound of doors opening, but not the real ambulances. The sound didn't match the hardware or echo with the same weight or mechanical complaint. It was lower and wetter, like something peeling open. A new shape appeared in the shattered rear windows. The other ambulance had followed them down the embankment. Its rear doors yawned open wide. From within, the shadowy figures began to emerge. They did not climb or step out. They spilled forth, pouring onto the ground like thick smoke given form, their arms terminating in fraying cords of muscle and darkness. Their faces, if they had ever possessed any, remained obscured in a haze throbbing with an unnatural heat. They approached the wreck, and not one of them gave the surviving paramedic a second glance. Dennis's body was still too battered to resist. He screamed as two of the wraiths reached inside, slid their hands beneath him as if he weighed nothing at all, and lifted him free of the wreckage, the straps that had once held him snapping like rotted thread. The injured paramedic watched, paralyzed with pain and horror, as Dennis was carried, limbs dangling, head lolling, through the broken door. They took him not to safety, but to the back of the wrong ambulance, where the shadows opened the doors wider and received him without ceremony. The paramedic, blood drying on his skin, remained where he had fallen, every breath a contest between will and pain. He did not cry out again, nor did he move. Somewhere nearby, a siren began to rise. Not the ordinary, warbled, shrieking cry of the real ambulance, but something preternatural and sinister, winding through the trees. Several minutes later, another wave of red and blue lights flickered across the nearby tree trunks as additional responders arrived. Voices followed, shouting directions, radio chatter slicing through the murk as flashlights speared the darkness. A new ambulance appeared at the crest of the embankment, flanked by two sheriff's cruisers. Within moments, medics and deputies were scrambling down the incline, navigating the wreckage with practiced urgency. They found the paramedic barely conscious, his head rolling to one side as someone pressed gauze against his wound. He tried to speak, but the words emerged fractured, feverish, and mostly unintelligible. He gestured toward the woods, toward the direction where the wrong ambulance had vanished, and kept repeating the same thing. "They took him. Dennis, the patient's gone." It took hours to secure the crash site, stabilize the injured, remove the deceased, and clear the debris. Daylight crept in beneath the canopy before the wrecked vehicle was finally pulled out with cables. In the meantime, paramedics and firefighters combed the embankment for a body, Dennis's body. They found nothing. No footprints, scraps of clothing, blood trails, or tire tracks. There were no signs of movement into the underbrush and no secondary vehicle. There was no indication whatsoever that Dennis had ever left the ambulance. Later, after the surviving paramedic had been airlifted out and stabilized, law enforcement worked to reconstruct what had happened. The vehicle's onboard systems had been badly compromised in the crash. The dash camera was shattered, its SD card cracked and unreadable. The front-facing collision sensor had failed mid-transit. Emergency dispatch logs confirmed the initial route, but GPS data dropped off just before the vehicle left the main road and descended the embankment. No second vehicle had been recorded on nearby traffic cams or roadside sensors. No tire tracks other than those belonging to the first responding unit were found near the point of impact. Officers searched the surrounding forest and ravine for hours. Drones were deployed, thermal scans were taken, cadaver dogs were brought in. Still, they found no sign of Dennis. Not in the woods, not in the wreckage, not anywhere. One of the search techs, interviewed days later, said he thought he'd seen something strange on one of the heat maps, a smear of heat moving uphill against the incline far too quickly. However, when the scans were reviewed later, the data was corrupted and the anomaly was gone. In his official statement, the surviving paramedic recounted every detail he could remember. He repeated Dennis's description of the other ambulance and its approach, the silence of its movement, the moment of impact, and the way the shadows had slipped inside the broken doors. He described how Dennis had been lifted out and taken, not by people, but by things, and how the vehicle that carried them simply left, soundless and without resistance, vanishing into the woods. The detectives didn't argue with him. They didn't accuse him of lying either. But the questions grew shorter and more cautious, and their pens slowed. When the interview was over, the report concluded that, due to incomplete data and the absence of a second identified vehicle, the exact nature and cause of the crash remains undetermined. A formal investigation into Dennis's disappearance followed. For a time, his name appeared in local newspapers and online bulletins. A missing persons alert was issued. Search parties were formed, drones were flown again. But after 3 weeks with no evidence, no sightings, and no leads, the case went cold. There was no body, no trace, and nothing left behind. Eventually, the attention faded, the articles stopped, the posters were taken down. The surviving paramedic, however, never forgot what he'd seen and heard. He never forgot the way Dennis looked at him as the wraiths dragged him away. Even though none of it made sense and no one could explain what happened, even though the world moved on as if Dennis had never existed, he knew what he saw, and no one could convince him otherwise. As for Dennis, he was never officially seen again, though rumors of his reappearance occasionally surfaced in communities of those interested in the paranormal and the bizarre, or among those who tended to stay out until the wee hours of the night, isolated and alone. To this day, some say that if you listen closely, late at night, you can hear the distant whine of a siren, an irregular, drawn-out wail, pitching awkwardly between mournful and mechanical, and that if you watch out your windows long enough, you might just see the source of the sound. An off-color, jaundiced ambulance with odd dimensions, driven by figures not quite human, with one more passenger than it had before. And those familiar with Dennis, whether from having met his acquaintance or from the myriad photos of him spread across the internet and on flyers, swore more than once that the passenger, in spite of its indistinct, malformed countenance, bore a striking resemblance. And should you ever find yourself unfortunate enough to encounter the ambulance, you'd best pray it doesn't turn into your driveway and come for you. Because there's always room for one more, they say. And as Dennis learned the hard way, there's no stopping the night siren when it comes to collect. You've been listening to The Night Siren by Craig Groeschek. Craig Groeschek is the creator and operator of the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, which has grown to nearly 500,000 subscribers, over 3,000 uploads, and more than 69 million video views in its 12 years of operation. He also oversees production of 4 weekly audio horror fiction podcasts, faithfully adapting and featuring the works of thousands of indie horror authors. A published author himself, dozens of his short stories have been adapted for this channel and other platforms.
He holds a bachelor's degree in communication from the University of Wisconsin's Stevens Point. In his free time, Groshek enjoys a wide range of outdoor activities, traveling, and spending time with three horror-loving children and his friends. Next, here's The Box by Layla Aaron. Part 1. Martin Greaves arrived at the Cortland Municipal Archive just after 8 on a Tuesday morning, 2 days after the city finally cut power to the upper floors. The building, a vast brutalist monolith set between two defunct overpasses, had been shuttered since 2007, but the government hadn't decided what to do with it until late last year. The concrete giant was to be demolished, a process delayed only by the bureaucracy's inability to decide what might still be inside. Martin's job was to find out. The contractor, DTI Logistics, had sent him the assignment in the same terse tone they used for everything. Standard municipal retention clearance, full digitization not required, time-sensitive due to environmental hazard designation, 6 weeks to inventory and log everything of note, discard what remained. He had done this sort of job before, though never in a building this size. The archive encompassed 11 above-ground floors and at least 5 below, and most of it had been locked up since the late 90s. A city within a city, its skin crumbling and its guts long since rotted. Martin preferred these jobs. The solitude suited him, and the process was consistent. Open a box, note its contents, check for water or pest damage, scan, if needed, log and label. Repeat. Still, the sheer size of the Cortland complex had given him pause, and not only because of the scale. The blueprints included in the assignment packet were full of contradictions, staircases leading nowhere, entire wings that didn't align between floors, half-buried corrections scrawled across copier artifacts. It was the kind of bureaucratic mess that spawned ghost stories among temp workers. He didn't believe in ghosts. He believed in mold, mislabeling, and a complete lack of institutional memory. His office was located on the second floor, though the elevator paused just slightly too long between the first and second landings, as though deciding whether or not to continue. The room itself had once served as a supervisor's workspace, judging by the desk and filing cabinets, but was now stripped of anything personal. He found a hardwired phone, disconnected, a rust-stained sink. One of the windows looked down into a sunken courtyard choked with vines and debris. The glass bore the scabbed impressions of decades worth of impact marks, stones maybe, or thrown trash, or birds. He plugged in the portable scanner, laid out his laptop, and arranged his pens and folders along the edge of the desk with the same neatness he applied to every job. Then he checked the Wi-Fi, none, as expected, and confirmed his offline database was running correctly. His phone would have to serve as the only means of outside contact, though service was patchy even above ground. That didn't matter. Martin had no one to call, and no one who would call him. By the time he'd organized the first of the floor-level inventory manifests, his inbox pinged with a new message from Gerald Withrow, his direct supervisor and project lead. From Gerald Withrow, gwithrow@dtilogistics.net. To Martin Greaves, mgreaves@dtilogistics.net. Subject, re on-site confirmation, Cortland Archive. Glad you made it in one piece. Let me know if the asbestos team is still camped out. Heard they were behind schedule on the sub-basement sweep. Just remember, this one's on a short leash. Building comes down in 6. We don't need everything, just enough to say we looked. Prioritize anything post-1985, and if you see anything with red tape or triangle seals, don't open it. Catalog and move on. Some old things are better left boxed and crushed. Martin read the message twice, then archived it. Withrow had a particular way of wording things. Sardonic. Cold. Always just ambiguous enough to hint at things better ignored. Martin had worked under him for almost 3 years and still didn't know what the man looked like.
By mid-afternoon, he'd cleared the corridor outside his office, removing half-collapsed stacks of city planning proposals and water-damaged transit authority blueprints. He set up a makeshift staging area near the stairwell that led downward, hauling his cart and portable light stand into position. Each descending floor seemed to hum louder than the last. The third floor was blocked off by a barricade of rolling cabinets, all tipped on their sides. He didn't question it. He simply logged the obstruction and moved on. The fourth was largely empty, save for a few disassembled cubicles and a stack of broken reels. The fifth and sixth housed boxes upon boxes of fire marshal reports, many of which were stamped as duplicates. The lower he went, the more the building changed. The walls turned darker, water stains branching like veins across the ceiling tiles. Some fixtures still worked, flickering fluorescent tubes that buzzed loud enough to mask the occasional groan of shifting pipes or settling concrete. There were no other people, no voices, no echo of work once done here. And yet, Martin often had the sensation, however fleeting, that someone had just turned a corner ahead of him, or that the lights hadn't been flickering until he arrived. The walls on sublevel 1 were lined with punch card cabinets and thick manila envelopes, all labeled in a crisp, mechanical font. The temperature dropped noticeably. In one hallway, the scent of ozone mixed with mildew. In another, the floor sagged slightly toward a central drainage grate, as though something had been very heavy, very wet, and very still for a long time. By the end of the first day, Martin had mapped three floors and fully inventoried two. He documented 8 structural hazards, logged 16 sealed boxes containing questionable materials, and noted that the elevator skipped the sublevels entirely. If one wanted to go lower, the stairwells were the only option. He returned to his office as the sun sank behind the courthouse across the street. From his window, the city looked 2 shades more orange than usual, the horizon divided by the crumbling skyline and the curl of smog. It was quiet here, and growing quieter. Martin didn't mind. The deeper he went into places like this, the more himself he became. Tomorrow, he'd tackle sublevel 2. Part 2. By the end of his first week, Martin had cataloged over 900 items, though not a single one had borne any obvious historical value. Most were duplicates, old records of supply chains, zoning amendments, interoffice memos, and transportation surveys yellowed beyond readability. The more he dug, the more it became apparent that much of the Cortland archive had served as a dumping ground for bureaucratic overflow, long before the city had designated it an archive in any official sense. The sublevels, however, were different. He first noticed the change on sublevel 2. The air turned heavier the farther he walked from the stairwell, and the dust took on a thicker, more oily consistency, clinging to his boots and clothes as though it possessed weight beyond what gravity should allow. The walls, once painted in a pale mint, had long since taken on a blotchy, bruised tone, and several bore signs of patch jobs and plastered-over cracks. At one junction, the signage abruptly shifted from English to French, though he found no indication the building had ever housed bilingual staff. By the time he reached sublevel 4, Martin was beginning to suspect the building had been altered at some point, illegally or unofficially. There were structural inconsistencies throughout, stairwells that terminated at sealed concrete walls, hallways that shrank by inches every few yards until they were barely wide enough for his shoulders to pass through, fire doors bolted from the inside, and vents that led nowhere. His flashlight flickered with increased frequency, and the batteries he carried seemed to drain faster than expected. The records here were stranger, too. Not only older, but often written in non-standard formats. Some were typed in symbols or ciphered blocks of text he couldn't immediately recognize. Many of the folders lacked any kind of legible heading or date stamp. He made note of these anomalies and stacked the items for later assessment, but the growing dissonance between what the building was supposed to be and what it appeared to contain began to needle at him in a way he hadn't experienced before. Midway through his second week, Martin discovered a side corridor behind a collapsed shelving unit on sublevel 4. The air within was colder than the surrounding level, and the floor dipped slightly toward a rusted drain whose cover had fused to the concrete long ago. The corridor ended in what appeared to be a service vestibule. No doors, only a heavy freight elevator set into a recess in the far wall. Unlike the others he had seen throughout the building, this one bore no markings. No number, no inspection sticker, no sign of recent use. Its doors were fully shut, but when Martin pressed the call button, the elevator arrived with a mechanical clunk that reverberated through the floor tiles. He hesitated before entering. There was no floor indicator, only a lever marked with a red vertical notch. When he pulled it, the elevator began to descend, smooth at first, then increasingly erratic, as though traveling on an unserviced line. The light inside flickered, then dimmed entirely. Martin waited, listening to the grinding of the mechanism and the faint creak of metal against shaft walls. It stopped with a jolt. When the doors finally opened, he found himself facing a corridor he did not recognize, one that did not appear on any blueprint he had studied. The air here was different, dry, but not in a natural way. It lacked the moldy, decayed scent that had permeated the rest of the archive. It smelled instead of dust stripped of time, as if whatever had gathered here had done so in a vacuum sealed off from decay. The walls were a smooth, slate-colored material, not unlike polished cement, but warmer to the touch when he pressed his palm against them. No signs marked the hallway. No fixtures lined the ceiling. Yet it was fully illuminated, by what source he could not determine. He walked slowly, cautiously, counting his steps out of habit. The corridor extended longer than seemed architecturally possible. There were no rooms, no branches, only a gradual descent, as though the floor had been built at a barely perceptible angle. He passed several alcoves, each empty, and a section of wall that bulged inward slightly. At the end of the corridor, he found a door. Unlike everything else in the Cortland Archive, it was untouched by grime or rust. A heavy steel frame surrounded it, and the surface bore no signs of wear, as though it had only just been installed. It was secured by a central locking mechanism, industrial, electronic, with no obvious interface. And above it, in letters etched so finely they might have been laser cut, was the label Room B9. Martin stared at the name for a long time, his mind immediately cycling through the blueprints he had studied. No such designation had ever appeared. The archive sublevels had followed an alphanumeric system, S1 through S5. No B levels, no room labels, no indication that anything beyond sublevel 5 existed at all. And yet, here it was, a place out of sequence, a space that should not have existed. He tried the handle, more from instinct than expectation. It didn't budge. No keypad, no card slot, no sign of how one might access the room beyond. He noted the lack of hinges or visible mechanisms on the exterior, suggesting the door opened inward, but offering no clue as to what powered or permitted its movement. Martin returned to his office that evening, unsettled in a way he couldn't quite name. His legs ached, his back felt tight. The elevator that brought him back up from the strange level had rattled louder on the ascent, and the call button had flickered after he'd exited, staying lit long after the elevator had returned to the bottom. That night, he attempted to email Withrow a brief summary of the discovery. From Martin Greaves, mgreaves@dtilogistics.net, to Gerald Withrow, gwithrow@dtilogistics.net. Subject: Room B9? Gerald, found something off blueprint today, marked Room B9, no record in schematics. Location inconsistent with listed sublevels. Possible Cold War edition? Door locked, no access panel.
Please advise.
The message sent, or seemed to, but never appeared in his sent folder. He tried forwarding it twice. Nothing. He saved a draft and opened it again, only to find the text missing, replaced by a blank body and an error message in the header. Recipient unreachable, no such address. When he rechecked his inbox, Withrow's last email had vanished. The lights above his desk dimmed, then steadied, then dimmed again. The bulb over the office sink buzzed once, spat out a flicker of blue light, and died. He leaned back in his chair, staring out into the hall. He waited, not for anything in particular, but with a sensation that something else had moved when he had not. In the silence, he thought he heard a faint dragging sound, something metallic and dry, like chains drawn slowly across tile. A second sound followed, softer, but unmistakably human. A whispering murmur, incomprehensible, yet unmistakably speech. It faded after a moment, or perhaps it had never been there at all. Martin powered down his equipment for the night, but before leaving, he turned back to the computer and reopened the draft email. This time, the subject line was gone, so was the recipient address. In its place, there was a single word: remember. Part 3. It took Martin 4 days to breach the door to room B9. He began with cataloging, photographs, measurements, and written reports. He traced the frame with chalk to track movement, suspecting at first some subtle shifting of the structure itself. Then came more forceful efforts, strikes with a mallet, attempts at leverage using a steel pry bar, then a portable angle grinder borrowed from a janitorial storage near the north stairwell. For a long while, the door held against each attempt. What finally worked, though Martin couldn't articulate how, was the application of sustained pressure at the precise point where the upper right corner met the frame, followed by a half-turn clockwise motion with the grinder's blade, and then, inexplicably, a push backward with both hands, as though dislodging a piece of cabinetry rather than a door secured by industrial means. The steel slab moved with an audible suction, like something unsealing after years in place. No air rushed out. No lights flickered in greeting. The door simply opened, revealing the space beyond. Room B9 was windowless and square, no more than 10 feet by 10. The walls were raw cement, cast in clean forms with no seams or discoloration, and the floor was the same, though covered with a faint white dust that gave way beneath Martin's boots with each step. Overhead, a single rectangular fixture buzzed with dim, yellowed light. There were no vents, no power outlets, no sign of how the room had maintained its condition in a facility where most spaces had decayed into mold and mildew. The air was neutral, neither stale nor fresh, as though neither time nor weather had touched it. At the center of the room sat a square metal table, unadorned and slightly pitted from age, its legs capped with rubber feet that had not left impressions in the dust. On top of the table sat a single banker's box, cardboard, standard issue, the kind he had already logged by the dozens. It bore no markings on the exterior, no labels, stamps, or barcodes. Martin approached slowly, aware of the stillness around him. The light overhead seemed unnaturally steady, its buzz a constant that offered no modulation, no sense of motion or life. When he placed his hands on the box, the cardboard was cooler than expected and faintly damp. He lifted the lid. Inside, he found media, disparate formats, all of them obsolete or on the cusp of obsolescence. VHS-C cassettes, mini-DV tapes, flash drives, and what appeared to be a Betacam reel, all wrapped in a static bag with his name printed in thermal ink across the plastic. Beneath these were manila envelopes containing printed photos, photocopies of handwritten notes, and a series of thermal paper printouts folded into triplicate.
Every item bore a date. Most dates were familiar, years of significance in Martin's life, though nothing as overt as birthdays or holidays. One envelope was labeled simply November 14, 1991, 3:36 p.m., library. Another read, Therapy, Session 004, Transcript, 2016. Some were tagged with file numbers, others with combinations of letters and digits that resembled internal coding systems he recognized from DTI's own archiving protocol. He did not remember ever having had therapy. He removed the topmost tape and turned it over in his hands. No label, just a faint indentation on the spine where a sticker had once been peeled away. He recognized the format. It was one he hadn't seen in years, used primarily by consumer camcorders in the late 90s and early 2000s. The camera in his office was compatible, though he hadn't used it since college. He set the tape aside and began to work through the rest of the contents, laying each item out with surgical care, photographing and logging them before sealing them into new archival sleeves. An hour later, the box was empty. He checked twice. He logged the contents, 87 unique items, and returned to the second floor. As he climbed the stairs, he tried to recall anything about the therapy transcript, the specific date in 1991, or the file labeled M. Greaves, Sub Audit 17. His memory offered nothing. No gap, no haze, only a complete absence, as though those moments had never belonged to him at all. That night, he played the tape. The image was grainy, the audio faint. It had been recorded indoors, judging by the acoustics, and featured a child, him, unmistakably, seated at a small table in front of a window that looked out onto a snowy backyard. A Christmas tree blinked in the background. He wore a red sweater. His hands fidgeted with a toy truck. A voice, off camera, asked him to describe his special dream. Martin, on screen, smiled and said, "The one where I opened the box." He did not remember this recording, nor did he remember that sweater, or that room, or ever having such a dream. The next morning, when he returned to room B9, the box was full again. The new contents were entirely different, no duplicates. This time, the material was heavier on written artifacts, spiral-bound notebooks he vaguely recognized, receipts for places he'd forgotten he'd visited, and a CD labeled First Voicemail, Mom, 2005. He remembered that year well. Her decline had started in February, the diagnosis confirmed in April, the last real conversation in June. He had saved the voicemail back then, but it had been lost when his phone corrupted later that year. He had never been able to retrieve it. The disc played flawlessly. Her voice was exactly as he remembered, too cheerful, too forced, fighting against a wave already cresting.
"Marty," she had said, "don't forget to take care of yourself. The world doesn't stop for any of us, no matter how much we wish it would. You're stronger than you think. Love you."
He listened to it three times before he ejected the disc and sealed it in a fresh sleeve. He labeled it meticulously and logged it into his private spreadsheet, separate from the DTI database. The official records would not include any of this. Each day thereafter, the box replenished. He tested it, emptying the contents completely, photographing the interior, even placing a blank note card inside with a handwritten date. Every morning, it was gone, replaced by a new collection of artifacts drawn, apparently, from his own life. Some were benign, report cards, canceled checks, lists in his handwriting. Others were stranger, audio recordings of conversations he had no memory of, surveillance-style videos showing him at coffee shops, riding trains, walking through cities he didn't remember visiting. And always, each item was tied to him. Not just in the label, but in the content, the intimacy,
the specificity that no one else could have known. He became obsessive. Sleep came in fits. Meals were consumed mechanically. His hands developed calluses from handling old plastic and paper. His eyes strained from the constant low-resolution playback. He spoke less aloud. He stopped responding to DTI check-ins. Emails arrived unanswered. Then, they stopped arriving altogether. Each night, he descended again. The hallway to room B9 remained unchanged. No dust gathered, no lights failed, no noise intruded. The building, for all its previous instability, seemed to calm around him the deeper his work became. And the box was always waiting. He stopped wondering how it replenished, or who, or what, might be supplying the contents. Instead, he began to question the nature of the items themselves. Were they records? Replicas? Were these things ever truly lost, or had they been excised, stolen, curated? Had he chosen to forget, or had someone chosen for him? By the end of the month, he no longer used his upstairs office. His cot had been moved to the hallway outside B9. He ate only when hunger dragged him from the trance. The line between inventory and identity had blurred, and in its place grew a singular, persistent compulsion to know everything the box had to offer. He told himself that once he'd seen it all, he would understand, that knowledge would bring closure. But the box was never empty for long. Part 4. There came a morning when Martin stood outside the door to room B9 and, for the first time in weeks, hesitated. He couldn't recall how many days had passed since the project had begun. The calendar in his old office, long abandoned, had fallen off the wall during a recent tremor, though he did not remember when exactly that had happened. The paper had curled at the edges like something scorched, though there had been no heat or fire, only the unyielding hum of light and silence and the soft, dusty exhalation of the lower halls. When he opened the door, the box was already full. He pulled on latex gloves with practiced motion, unfolded a clean notepad, and clicked his pen, each movement repeated from the day before and the day before that. If he did not repeat the process precisely, he feared something might shift again. Some small hinge of reality might loosen just enough to open further. The first item that morning was a compact flash drive in a padded envelope marked with a black sticker bearing the initials MARTIN. There were no periods on any of the other tags. This one was deliberate, as though the name had been segmented, broken apart into an acronym, or into something else entirely. He logged the envelope, photographed it, and then inserted the drive into his personal laptop. The folder that opened bore a single time-stamped file, Session 5, Cam 2, Final, .mp4. The video opened in a cold, clinical room, a couch, a coffee table, a diploma hung crookedly on the wall. The figure seated across from the camera was him, Martin, hair slightly longer than he wore it now, dressed in a gray collared shirt he could not recall ever owning. His voice was soft, barely audible beneath the static interference that bled in along the recording's lower register. "I don't think it's real," he said. "I know the door isn't supposed to be there. I know the building doesn't want me inside it, but I go anyway. And when I do, I forget things, not just for a minute. They're gone, like they were never mine." The therapist's voice, if that was what the person off camera was, replied, but the words were muffled, buried under the low-frequency hum that almost resembled breathing. Martin watched the version of himself on screen lean forward. "You don't understand. It's not just memories disappearing. It's the meaning of them. The glue between things. That feeling you get when you remember your first apartment or your mother's handwriting or the weight of the keys to your childhood home. That's gone. Not just the thing, but the shape of it in my mind, like someone has taken scissors to the film strip of my life. Martin paused the video, he scrolled back, and he watched again. There was no recognition, no flicker of familiarity, and yet the words could have come from him, had come from him, if the timestamp was to be believed. He checked his hands. They trembled slightly, even when still. The rest of the items that day followed a theme. Scraps of correspondence, old voicemails transcribed into neat courier font, insurance claims tied to accidents he didn't remember being involved in. A torn photograph of himself standing in front of a gray building he didn't recognize, with the caption, "Visit number 3, do not linger," printed faintly on the back. None of it triggered any response beyond confusion, and yet he knew, deep down in some place older than knowledge, that it all belonged to him. That night, the box offered something new. A video clip labeled Subway Footage 12A 2014. No location, no clear source. Martin played it. It began with shaky, grainy footage, security camera quality, of a crowded underground platform. The crowd was thin, mostly commuters. After 30 seconds, the camera panned, or perhaps automatically tracked, a figure near the edge of the platform. Martin. He stood facing the tracks, back hunched, lips moving in a steady rhythm. The audio was faint, but enough of the sound carried to pick out fragments of speech. "Before they find me. Not here, not again. I just need time. Can't keep it all. Can't hold it." The image shook again as a train passed, obscuring him, and when it cleared, he was gone. Martin rewound the clip and watched it again. The date, 2014, should have placed him in Denver. He had been working contract IT that spring, managing digitization protocols for municipal court records. No recollection existed of any trip to New York or Boston or anywhere else with a system that resembled the platform in the video. He checked old calendars and work logs. Nothing contradicted the fact that he had not been there. And yet, there he was. He began to doubt the certainty of his own biography, not in grand strokes, but in a thousand tiny details that, under closer scrutiny, no longer fit. The order of events, the colors of previous apartments, the faces of co-workers he once knew intimately, now blurred and featureless in memory. He opened a drawer and found a birthday card addressed to Matt. He stared at it for 10 minutes before realizing that the handwriting on the envelope was his. The next morning, he found he couldn't remember how to reach the stairwell from room B9. The hallway outside had shifted, grown longer or perhaps more narrow, and several doors had appeared along its length, none of which had existed before. When he opened them, he found supply closets full of empty boxes, mold-lined offices with chairs bolted to the floors, a break room with a kettle still warm on the counter. He had not seen another soul in weeks. He no longer expected to. When he finally reached the upper level, the floor numbering had changed. What had been the second floor was now labeled P3. The elevator no longer displayed its interior panel. The stairwell looped back on itself when he tried to descend beyond sublevel 1. A hallway he had walked 100 times now terminated in a blank wall. The building was reacting. He tested it. He wrote messages on scrap paper and posted them outside his office door. He laid down a trail of folders leading from the stairwell. Each attempt at breadcrumbing failed. The signs vanished. The folders were found scattered in different rooms. His own writing had altered, sometimes sloppy, sometimes cursive, sometimes in block capitals. He spoke aloud, out of frustration. He accused the archive itself, accused the room, accused the box. "You're taking them from me," he whispered, pacing the threshold of room B9, fists clenched. "I know what I've lost. I know it's not just my memory anymore. It's the shape of me, the continuity, the thread." The light in the room flickered once and then held steady. "You're not preserving anything," he continued. "You're dismantling it, turning me into a record, into artifacts and noise." He fell silent. Later that night, a new file appeared in the box. It was labeled M. Greaves, Audio Replica, Session 1. When he played it, he heard himself. The same accusations, the same pacing footsteps, the same bitterness in his voice. Every word he had spoken aloud was there, but the file's metadata listed the recording date as 2 days prior. That was when he realized the box was not only cataloging what he'd forgotten, it was predicting what he would say, or worse, determining it. He stared at the monitor for a long time after that, wondering if there was anything left that hadn't already been labeled, time-stamped, and filed away, wondering what part of him was still original, what remained that had not been absorbed, indexed, and replayed. Outside, the lights hummed with renewed intensity. The hallway walls gleamed faintly as if freshly polished. Martin closed the lid on the box. For now. Part 5. Martin first noticed the change beneath the table in room B9 on a morning much like the rest. Air still, light flat and yellow, the box awaiting him in its usual spot, half-lidded and bulging slightly with fresh contents. But today, as he knelt to pick up a folder that had slid to the floor, his fingers caught the edge of something rough. A seam in the cement, no wider than a coin's edge, running along the base of the western wall. He hadn't seen it before, and yet the dust pattern said otherwise. The table, always centered before, had shifted slightly off its mark, leaving the impression of its previous placement like a shadow baked into the concrete. When he moved it aside and brushed the area clean, he saw it clearly, a thin rectangular hatch recessed into the floor, ringed with rivets and fitted with an inset handle. He hesitated before pulling. It took effort, grinding metal, a protest of hinges, and the smell that rose from beneath was old, dense, and bitter. Not rot in the traditional sense, but the kind of decay born from sealed spaces where things had once lived and then forgotten how. The darkness below accepted his flashlight without resistance, but what it revealed made his throat tighten. A crawl space, no more than 4 feet deep, extended under the room in a narrow channel. Its walls were older than those above, made of unpainted stone and concrete pocked with time. Martin slid down carefully, knees braced, light in hand. The temperature dropped immediately, as though the hatch had opened into a cellar rather than a structural recess. He found the furniture first. Rusted steel chairs collapsed in on themselves, a cot frame twisted at the joints, the remnants of a desk whose drawers had fused shut with corrosion. Around the perimeter, stacked in loose arrangements, sat dozens of metal canisters, film reels, most labeled in block script, all yellowing from age and moisture. Each one bore a name. Trial number 07, H. Falconer. Trial number 12, J. Deem. Trial number 23, K. Ingram. Trial number 31, B. Colfax. There were over 40 in total, their lids marked in red grease pencil. Some bore additional labels: declined, no stability, or externalized. A few had the tape sealed back across their spools as though rewound in haste or rejection. He selected one without thinking. Trial number 19, D. Silva. The projector he used to review it, recovered weeks earlier from the AV supply room on sublevel 2, had long since been modified to accommodate various formats. He loaded the reel that night, fed it through the teeth and guides, and closed the housing with the click of old plastic. The film began in a blank, bare-walled room with a chair at the center. A man sat facing the camera, his eyes unfocused. A thin line of blood ran from his left nostril. He spoke without prompting. "Corpus memini, nomen Dei." He repeated it over and over. "Corpus memini, nomen Dei. Corpus memini." Each repetition grew fainter. Blood pooled beneath his chin. His head lolled once, then again. By the 12th cycle, he was leaning so far to the left that the frame captured more of the wall than his face. Then the reel ended. No outro, no artifact, just the stuttering tick of the sprocket claw reaching for what wasn't there. Martin sat in the dark for a long time after. He rewound the film and watched it again, and again. He wrote the phrase down, sounding it out phonetically, breaking it apart by syllables. "Corpus memini, nomen Dei. I remember the body. Delete the name." The phrase echoed through his head, finding purchase in places it shouldn't. He dreamed of it that night, or thought he did. Dreamed of men and women reciting it like prayer, seated in half-lit rooms beneath buildings that did not exist above ground, their eyes black and mouths full of smoke. When he returned to the crawlspace the next morning, he found the words etched into the far wall in his own handwriting. He did not remember writing them. He touched the grooves to confirm their depth. The characters followed the exact penmanship of his notes, the slant, the pressure, even the way he formed his R's, over-curved and slightly raised. The foundation of the Cortland archive was failing. That much was obvious. Pipes groaned in the ceilings above. Sirens sounded at odd hours with no pattern or purpose. Water stains bloomed in real time across the floors of sublevel 2, and the lights no longer flickered. Some doors refused to open. Others no longer led where they had. Martin documented the decay with increasing obsession, not out of concern, but as evidence, as confirmation of the pattern he believed he was uncovering. The building had not simply grown sick, it had been infected. And whatever entity lived within room B9, whatever curated the box and replenished its contents, was merely a symptom of a deeper rot, one embedded in the cement and steel long before he had arrived. The footage that surfaced in the box that night bore no label at all. He played it regardless. It opened with darkness, movement audible but unseen. Then a faint click, a flare of light. The static snap of an old security camera kicking on. The image stabilized to reveal room B9. The box was visible in the corner of the frame. The table had been pushed aside. Martin appeared in the doorway. He looked thinner and paler than before. His movements were tight and halting, as if governed by a rhythm not entirely his own. He entered the room, carrying a drill in one hand and a canister of industrial foam in the other. He said nothing. Over the next 6 minutes, he worked methodically, sealing the perimeter of the room. Foam in the seams, reinforcement of the hatch below. He bolted the interior of the door shut using steel brackets affixed directly to the wall. Then he returned to the center of the room, where he knelt beside the box, and opened the lid. He withdrew a single sheet of paper. From the camera angle, its contents were unreadable. He stared at it for a long time. Then he spoke. "Identity is cancerous if left unchecked," he said. "It metastasizes through memory, through attachment, through name. Better to excise it, better to preserve what can't evolve. That's why I'm here. That's why I agreed." He looked up directly at the lens. "It only needs one to remember, one to hold the index. All the rest can be filed away." The recording ended there. Martin sat for hours afterward, trying to determine when the footage had been captured. The timestamp was missing, the file name indecipherable, the metadata scrambled. He ran analysis programs, checked logs, and cross-referenced his own activity, but there was no match. No record of that moment ever existing. And yet, he had watched himself perform each action with absolute clarity. He rose, went to the door, and checked the brackets. They were in place, and he did not remember installing them. Part 6. The building died with less ceremony than expected. A week after city permits cleared and contracts were signed, the Cortland Municipal Archive was reopened, not by clerks or auditors or those trained in record preservation, but by men in dust-coated vests, clipboards tucked under their arms, and respirators slung across their chests. They arrived in twos and threes, trailing heavy cables and fluorescent markers, measuring walls with lazy precision and testing for lead or asbestos with plastic instruments that blinked red more often than green. The building had long since failed its codes, and no one expected to find anything worth saving. The first man to descend below sublevel 2 returned after 15 minutes, claiming he'd seen a nest of rats the size of cats and that the stairs had buckled beneath his weight. The others laughed and offered no challenge. Their job was not to verify floor plans, but to level them, and no one on the crew had any intention of digging into places the blueprints didn't even acknowledge. And yet, someone went down anyway. It might have been a junior inspector, or perhaps one of the subcontractors assigned to cable clearance. No one could remember who, precisely. The report filed afterward offered little clarity, only that a single item had been found in what had once served as a basement utility room. A cardboard box, standard size, unmarked, with a faint impression along one edge that suggested it had spent a long time pressed beneath something heavy. Inside, there was only a USB stick. The box was tagged for disposal, but the stick was brought to the trailer, plugged into a station laptop, and opened without ceremony. The file it contained bore no extension, only the file name, file:martin. It launched in a proprietary player, one the technician didn't recognize and couldn't close once it began. The footage showed a man seated at a steel table. Behind him, cement walls, unadorned. A single overhead light cast a pale circle that caught the lines of his face in soft, static motion. He looked neither young nor old. His hair was short, dark, neatly trimmed. His clothes were plain. He did not blink for the first minute. Then he spoke. "This is the last entry. The index is full, redundancies eliminated, cross-references complete." He smiled faintly. "There was a time I thought I could walk away," he continued, his voice low but steady. "That I could burn it all, scatter it, refuse to be filed. But it doesn't work like that. Identity is a closed system. It loops. And if you try to sever the loop, you just make a copy. One more duplicate. One more trial." Behind him, the light dimmed for a moment, then returned. He leaned forward, folding his hands on the table. "Someone has to remember, even if it isn't me. Even if what's left of me fits inside a box." A pause followed, longer this time. His gaze dropped to the surface of the table. His fingers traced something there, just out of frame. Then he looked up again. "It has to be someone." A flicker of something behind his eyes. Regret, maybe, or anticipation. "Might as well be me." The screen froze. Then the file closed. No one could retrieve it after that. The USB stick, when reinserted, showed no data. Attempts to scan it returned errors. Eventually, it was placed back into the box, which was sealed and logged as Miscellaneous Ephemera, Archive Incident, then stored on a shelf in a municipal warehouse slated for closure the following year. The Cortland archive was demolished 10 days later. No room B9 was found. No records were recovered. No one ever located Martin Greaves. And yet, somewhere, the box remains. That was The Box by Leyla Aaron. Leyla Aaron is a Turkish-American author whose psychological horror stories explore the unsettling spaces where the past and present collide. Her work often delves into themes of cultural memory, displacement, and the unseen forces lurking behind the familiar. Known for her slow-burning, atmospheric narratives, Aaron creates richly layered tales that invite readers to lose themselves in her characters' unraveling realities. Born to Turkish parents in the United States, Aaron grew up surrounded by both the traditions of her heritage and the eerie folklore of her adopted home. This blend of influences shaped her fascination with ghost stories, ancient superstitions, and the delicate interplay of identity and environment. After earning a degree in literature, she worked as a folklorist, collecting oral histories and regional myths before turning to fiction. Now, living in a renovated craftsman home tucked into the woods of the Pacific Northwest, Aaron draws on her diverse background and the haunting beauty of her surroundings to craft tales of creeping dread and psychological disquiet. Friends, I'm all for stories that explain everything and wrap up with a nice pretty bow, but what really gets me going is weird stuff like this. Liminal spaces, unknown antagonist motivations, bizarre reflections of everyday life. Sort of like the uncanny valley of fiction. It's not overtly threatening, like a monster or a serial killer, but it sends all of your internal alarms into the red. Along those lines, I owe my thanks to Craig Groshek and Leyla Aaron for tonight's stories. As always, I'll be back with a new episode of Horror Hill next week. Until then, friends, stay spooky. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted, narrated, scored, and finalized by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Additional music by Nikki McSorley. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at submissions@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your work considered for future production. If you enjoyed tonight's episode, why not help us spread our dark presence online? You can follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. It helps us out a lot and also keeps you up to date on new episodes. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend signing up to be a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. Head to ChillingTalesForDarkNights.com to get started. If you're looking for someone to narrate or handle audio production for your own personal project, I just so happen to know a guy. Email me at ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com and we can talk details. That's ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.